Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! It's been great today, isn't it?
Sure. And so
I think we've reached peak wank.
Clear them out as well. There needs to be a new start.
Away with you, beggar. Away with you, beggar. Away with you, beggar. With you, beggar.
小橋のラリアットは小橋はもう本当に腕をぶん回して振り切ってホームランぶっ放す感じでね。それこそ首を脱いでいく感じで、まあそれぞれ個性はあるけど、結果的には。Enter,
stranger. Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. I'm here. I'm drinking Nescafe Gold Espresso Edition, but it still can't overcome my deep tiredness. I've been away all weekend. I was at the UK Board Games Expo playing board games in Birmingham. But then AAA was missing her daddy, so I came back a day early. I hope everything is good where you are, friends. And this is going to be a super chill stream. Earlier on today, I launched the Academic Agent Retrospective. Three episodes have dropped already. So I don't want this stream to be too long because I want people to go back and watch my glorious retrospective. If you're new to this channel, the retrospective videos will catch you up with all of the essential Academic Agent content that you've missed over the past 6 years. We started off with Sadiq Khan, bit of red meat for the trucks. Then we had Tony Blair, bit of a deep dive into some of the awful things he did to this country and his NGO network that's currently operational in the world. Then we looked at immigration, which contains probably some of the most blackpilling videos I've ever made. But the journey is just getting started, friends. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., there's going to be a four-hour edition of Academic Agent Retrospective called Deconstructing the Left. And I have to say that, I've been trawling through my archives and putting together these kind of themed compilations. And I think some of my best ever videos are in there. I mean, they're in that Deconstructing the Left video tomorrow. So, some of the ones today were a little bit stats heavy for my tastes, but still, I enjoyed it, and I tell you what, that Enoch Powell one still packs a punch, I tell you. Anyway, why are we gathered here today? Yes, 4 hours. It's a four-hour-long video. Yeah, I think it goes 3 hours and 45 minutes or something like that. So, yeah, you better strap in for that one. There's only going to be one edition of the retrospective tomorrow, and then subsequent parts will follow. There's one on degeneracy on Wednesday that's going to drop, and there could be a number six on Wednesday as well. We'll see. There's going to be there's a little tie-in sale on the academic agency along to go along with the retrospective. If you just use the code RETRO, I'll give you £100 off any of the bundles, any of the bundle deals that's on there. Okay. So, yeah, the Zoomers are Coomers video is the final video in the On Degeneracy set. Okay. It's like I'm doing my greatest hits, but when you've been around for 6 years, that means you've got, you know, I've got like a number of best ofs, friends. All right. So what are we going to do on this stream? Yes, I'm going to be taking questions. Now, I've opened up the Super Chats, and obviously you can send Super Chats, but in the spirit of trying to welcome in some newcomers and in the spirit of good times with old friends as well, because, you know, it's partly to help welcome in, because I realize that there are people who've just been around for like a few months, like, for example, Chris Gard, Morbekai, who we saw there, who, you know, is a relative newcomer to our circles, and he hasn't necessarily been on the same journey as all the rest of us. So one of the ideas I had is that, well, what's a good way of for people to catch up in a way that they can actually like hang out in the live chat as well? And I thought, well, you know, it'll take some effort, but maybe these retrospective videos will help to, you know, understand why some of us are so, some of us have got the positions that we've got. And also to look back on some of the, you know, like me 5 years ago is not the same man as I am today. And to also, you know, I mean, even in the stuff I play today, yeah, there was a lot of blackpilling material in there, but there was also a few notes I was like, I'd never say that today. I mean, you know, there were a few notes where I was like, yeah, I was naive in some of those videos, but that's for you to spot, I suppose. So what I want to do in this stream, it's not going to be that long. I'm just going to take a few questions, and I will do my best to answer them. The only caveat is that it's going to be a non-politics stream, non-politics. I will take any questions that are not of an explicitly political nature. And the reason for that is because tomorrow night on Unpopular Opinions, there's going to be the politics version of the Q&A, which I thought would be a neat little tie-in to this retrospective that we're doing. It's also a good time that I'll take any questions, again, with the view of bedding in the newbies and cementing our friendships with the old timers. So let me have a look then. I consider that a political question, SS, so I can't take that. Let's see what else. Monothalmus started watching AA in 2017. That's pretty good vintage, I would say. When the Deconstructing the Left video airs tomorrow, you will see there are videos in there from 2016. And I think the most any of those videos from 2016 have, in terms of view count, are 3,700 views. So that's quite a low view count by my standards. So very few people have actually watched my earliest content, but there's some good stuff in there. So I think it'll be interesting to do a little watch along with that tomorrow afternoon. Let's have a look. AA monograph when? I've written 7 monographs, Nick. 7. Yeah, I mean, everybody going on about the glorious 4 hours, but most episodes of Unpopular Opinions are 4 hours long, you know. Yeah, if it starts at 2 and it goes on for 4 hours, it'll be done by 6. And a Popper Opinions is on at 9, so that's not going to be a problem. Excellent. A lot of people were ODing on Black Pills watching that. I did watch, I didn't comment, but I was watching the live chat, and in between people complaining about the background music, which is why I stopped doing it, because some people will like the music, other artists like Years the Eunuch would complain about the background music, and so I just kind of quietly dropped it in the end. I did run a number of polls, and every time I ran the poll, keep the music would beat, drop the music. But in the end, I listened to the vocal minority. The organized minority always has power, and the organized and vocal minority in the comments were the ones who ended up winning. That's real political power. Okay, let's see if I can find any. Nobody's asking any. Everybody's just kind of banally talking to each other. Where are my questions, friends? Where are my questions? Yeah, the degeneracy one is 3 hours, 45 minutes. Oh, no, sorry. The degeneracy one is just under an hour and a half. So the degeneracy one is 90 minutes long. And I actually had to censor the degeneracy one because the original videos had been age restricted. Two of the original videos showed Booba. So I had to press. You'll see when you watch that one, there is moments where there's a censorship sign that comes up because Susan does not like boobs. So there we go. Where else? I'm going to have a sip of my coffee. AA, I know you aren't keen on fiction, but apart from Hideous Strength, do you have any other fiction tips to share? What's Hideous Strength? What's that then? I don't have any fiction tips. I don't know how to write fiction, as anybody who's read the complete works of Maxwell House will know, the collected works of Maxwell House. I'm not really particularly good at writing fiction. So I don't have many tips. I would study Vladimir Propp and Roland Barthes' cardinal functions, which I talked about in a previous Deepest Law. There's a Deepest Law called The Structural Analysis of the Mr. Men. And that starts with some heavy focus on narratology and plot. So, yes. Still on keto. James Good, I have not been on keto since I went to my Eyes Wide Shut party, had a drink and fell off the wagon. So I need to get back on keto at some point. But it's been like a week or so, at least 2 weeks since I went to that party. So how much do you make per copy sold of The Populist Delusion? To be honest, I don't know. I think it depends where it's sold and in what format it's sold, but you know, it'll be a few quid, anywhere between like $3 and $8, I suppose. But who knows? Somebody asked me the other day how many copies has been sold. It's clear none of these people have ever written books before, because publishers just don't tell you until you get an invoice receipt thing at the end of every year, and then they'll give you a breakdown of the sales figures and a check, usually once per year. I could just ask Mike, but I don't know. I'm kind of used to just not knowing. Of my previous books, some of them, that check that comes through is literally like, well, I'll get you a Starbucks if you're lucky, you know. Other ones, there's one book, The Defenders of Liberty, where that's been out for a few years now, and every year it's like, yeah, here's 900 quid. I was like, holy shit, well, why are so many people buying that one? So, because that was an expensive book. So it seems like that one, Defenders of Liberty, sold a good number of copies. The Shakespeare ones, the first year sales tend to be the biggest ones because that's all the libraries buying it, and then thereafter it's just a cup of coffee. Then eventually it's just like naught. You know, nobody bought this book in the last year. You know, there's usually at least one or two, but I don't think I've got checked through for zero yet. But I think it has to be above a certain threshold for them to bother writing the check. What are your thoughts on homeschooling, and would you consider homeschooling AAA? How do you socialize AAA without regular contact with school friends, for example? Well, rather controversially, Kyra Scuro, I'm not really that up for homeschooling. For one, I don't have the time or the temperament. I don't think Mrs. AA has the right time or temperament for it either. But also, I kind of feel like the experience of navigating the social hierarchies of school is actually necessary. I think it's actually important. Now, that's not to diss anybody who does homeschool. I know Radlib homeschools. I think Lady of Shalott, at least during the pandemic, was homeschooling. I don't know if she's continued with that. But I'm not that keen on the idea of doing it myself. I've been looking at schools. There's a lot of very, very good schools in the area that I live in, some of them private, some of them state schools. I think the most important thing for someone of AAA's age is that they're going to be safe. It's going to be a nice kind of environment where the classes aren't too big and they all know each other. I'm not actually that worried about the pause, as it were, in those schools. I've been around them. I've kind of been on their sites. I've looked at their general philosophies, and I don't really see that much pause in the actual primary schools. When it comes to secondary school, I'd have to have another look, because obviously we're talking about like 10 years time. But yeah, I'm just going to send it to a school, you know. Then again, a lot of that is down to catchment area. I'm just lucky enough to live in an area where there are a lot of good schools. In fact, I live in two areas where there are lots of good schools, because here in the Lodge, there are lots of good schools near here as well, including one school that is so pretty and nice. It's fucking expensive, but it's so gorgeous that I'm tempted to send her there just for the building alone. Yeah, there's one school I've got in mind where it's kind of relatively small and everybody knows each other. I think when you're like a 5-year old, that's probably the best thing, you know. Okay. Colonel Crayon says, does objective moral truth exist? What are your thoughts on non-cognitivism and error theory? Well, Colonel Crayon, if you have a look at my fifth book, which is called Shakespeare's Moral Compass, I give a pretty much a book-length treatment of that question, using Jonathan Haidt's Righteous Mind and his the kind of intuition over reasoning model. And the first half of the book is me fleshing that out. I compare it against Thomas Sowell's Conflict of Visions, and then I go back and look at the Reformation era with that sort of stuff in mind, and then I take that model and I use it on Shakespeare's plays to see what comes out the other end. All of that does lead me to believe that there is something like a universal objective moral truth that cuts across cultures and history. And I honestly think that the set of vices and virtues that Thomas Aquinas came up with, or the Aristotelian virtue ethics, I would say Aquinas's vices and virtues are kind of an elaborated version of Aristotelian virtue ethics. I think pretty much there on the money. You know, it doesn't matter what your religion is, doesn't matter where you come from. It seems to me that if there's an objective moral set of laws, it's those ones. And in fact, when that retrospective airs on Degeneracy on Wednesday, you'll see some of that thinking filter through into my wider cultural thought as well. I think there's a reason that ancient wisdom inscribed into myth and legend taboos on certain things. You know, those seven deadly sins, the cardinal sins, pride, lust, gluttony, and so on, there's a reason. And when you're reading Aquinas or even when you're reading Aristotle, you're not just reading like the thought of one man. You're reading the accumulated wisdom of thousands of people. This is like the inherited wisdom of your ancestors. And I genuinely believe that the hubris of the moderns, as they're called, or the modern hubris of thinking that you can just overturn all of that or ignore all of that is destructive. And I think that we're actually living through the speed run of that destruction right now. We're seeing all around us what happens when a culture totally abandons the traditional virtues. You know, I don't think Aquinas would be that surprised to see that, you know, our societies are going to the dogs. Because what do we see all around us? We see pride, we see gluttony, we see lust, we see envy, petty envy everywhere. We see anger daily in the outrage cycle on social media. We see, you know, wrath. So I genuinely do believe there is an objective moral truth. And it stands to reason if there's such a thing as human nature and a common human nature, those same human traits are going to manifest in pro-social or antisocial ways. Okay, and the fact of the matter is that you know, let's just say on sexual mores. Okay, the fact of the matter is that certain lifestyles give you more disease. They give you you know, they lead to worse outcomes for the community. So there has to be prohibitions on them to try to push human beings into doing more pro-social things that are going to be for the general good of the community and the species and so on, rather than to the detriment of them. So I do think you can take a kind of group evolutionary view and come to the same conclusions as Aquinas. In fact, I had a friend who was a scholar, Christian scholar, who... we basically agreed on everything apart from, like, he was a kind of hardcore what church was he from? Was he a Catholic? Pretty much, though, he was I can't remember his denomination, but he was a hardcore Christian. He almost became a monk and then he became a scholar. I was using an almost totally kind of quote-unquote scientific evolutionary approach, and we just had the same conclusions on everything. It's just that he started with God and I was starting with Darwin. Hey, why are you not into your ancestors, Ahura Mazda? Do you read the Gethas? I don't know what any of that stuff is. Pleasure Pain says, who will replace Jeremy Paxman on University Challenge? It'll probably be that lesbian who replaced Stephen Fry on QI. She's always like the number two replacement on these things, because they have to bring in diversity and they'll give it to a woman and she's authority. What's her name? Sandy Toksvig. They'll probably give it to her, I'd imagine. What else? Monothama says, you once hinted at a stream about some AA deep lore, stories of dates, anecdotes, and so on. Do you see yourself getting back to that? Well, I never say never. I am a creature of whim and whimsy. Probably not, because I'm married and so on. Jacob says, that Bowie codpiece in Labyrinth, yeah, tell me about it. There's going to be the Bowie and the Kubrick Deepest Laws next month, probably. Just you need to gear up to those. Yeah, After Virtue by McIntyre is good. Yeah. People are talking about Bowie for some reason. Edmund Trebus says, serious question. Feelings when Stone Cold stunned Regal for reading Hamlet. I don't actually remember that, but I seem to remember there was a really amazing era of Stone Cold when he kind of turned heel and teamed up with Kurt Angle and Vince McMahon for a while. Did it happen in that era? It was like a 2001 sort of time. That was a glorious kind of 4 or 5 month stretch with those three. I always remember he wore the little Kurt Angle wore the little cowboy hat and they were playing guitar and stuff. That was a really, really fun stretch of Raw. Yeah. Phillips Geekery, have you covered Nietzsche? What is opinion of him? Yes, we've covered Nietzsche on Cigar Stream. There is if you go, well, you'd have to join the channel, but if you go in the archives and type in Nietzsche, he should, I think Daughter of Albion is into Nietzsche. And so she came on and we did a stream called The Importance of Nietzsche, but also the very recent streams we did on social conservatism and nature had a lot of Nietzsche talk in there as well. And I'm sure he's come up on other occasions as well. So just do a type in the, search my channel and type in Nietzsche. You'll probably have to join to access some of those videos, but yeah, we have discussed Nietzsche before. In terms of my opinion on him, I've got a lot of sympathies with the master versus slave morality stuff. I think he's right on a lot of that, undeniably, and a lot of Nietzsche filters into some of the, a lot of the other thinkers we think about as well, like Evola and the various other guys, where there is a kind of striving towards Bowden is a very Nietzschean kind of thinker. So I do think there is a lot of Nietzschean influence. Bronze Age Pervert, obviously, is kind of a modern Nietzschean. And there's undeniable truths that Nietzsche gets at. I actually like some of his later ones. Was there one called Twilight of the Idols? That's what it's called. What's that one? It's kind of like a best of at the end of his career. Is it called Twilight? Yeah, Twilight of the Idols, or How to Philosophize with a Hammer. I love that one. Nobody ever talks about that, but I really dig the way that is written and the way it's put together. So, yeah, Twilight of the Idols, probably my favorite Nietzsche book. Lady of Shalott says, do you think David Bowie hastened in the degeneracy we are now living with? He pushed the boundaries of sexuality and gender. I love Bowie, by the way. I think Bowie, the strange thing about a lot of Bowie's kind of boundary pushing is that he did it in a, funny enough, Nietzschean manner. He did a lot of the Bowie material is exploring themes that are pretty straightforwardly Nietzschean. This is extremely marked on his early albums, like Man Who Sold the World, Hunky Dory, and on Ziggy Stardust, of course. But also, Ziggy Stardust is... there is a... How can I say? There's an exploration of the godlike hero, Carlylean hero style worship of the rock star as God. Okay? And in that moment where Ziggy Stardust is saying, give me your hands because you're wonderful, there's an echo of Hitler in there. And I even think Bowie says this in an interview somewhere that, you know, Hitler was the first rock star. So there is a kind of interesting fascination with that dynamic between the rock god and the peons in the crowd that Bowie is constantly playing with. So I don't think Bowie is a kind of straightforward, quote unquote, degenerate. There is always this feeling with Bowie that he's playing with voices and that he's playing with concepts and that he's interrogating those concepts as well. It's not this kind of LGBT pride waving bullshit that we get today. He's always doing something much more interesting than that. Just take a look at his video to something like the song Fashion. It's clear that, you know, obviously Bowie was a fashion icon, but it's clear that he's saying something about the fashion industry and how vapid it is in that song as well. So I just think Bowie is too clever an artist to just say, oh, well, he was degenerate, you know. I would also say that Bowie failed to break America like, say, the Beatles did or like the British Invasion did. And it's funny, if you ever go to America and you hear a Bowie song play, it will almost always be Golden Years. You know, Golden Years is everywhere on American boomer radio, or sometimes Young Americans, but you don't hear his other songs that often. So I don't actually know how big Bowie's stateside cultural impact was, but we'll return to that and all of those questions when we do Bowie Deepest Law. Yeah, exactly, SS. LGBT is all about victimization and collective. Bowie was all about this kind of... He was a godlike figure. The Ziggy Stardust character was a godlike figure. And even later, Bowie is always playing with that idea. You know, he's always coming from this oddly Nietzschean place. Even if you go and watch the original videos for Heroes, You know, he's singing about being a hero and he's got a spotlight shining from behind him. And occasionally you see the light literally come through the crack of his legs as if the light is shining out of his ass. You know, that must be deliberate. They didn't do these things accidentally. I don't believe that. I mean, I'm sure that there's been attempts to try to co-opt Bowie by current stuff, but the material is just so much more interesting than that. There is a lot of outsider individualism in Bowie, I would say. That, you could say, is coming from a place that is non-mainstream. But I see him as a kind of, you know, this is the artist does tend to stand outside of artists are never normies. They're usually odd people in some way. And, you know, in some way, Bowie, if you want to put it that way, was there to, tell people who were a little bit different, who felt like they stood apart from the crowd in some way, that actually, yeah, there are other people like you as well, and that's all right. That, you know, to stand apart from the crowd can be interesting. It can lead to interesting stuff. You know, I'm not trying to say, though, that Bowie never did anything degenerate, and he did take a shitload of coke and engage in all sorts of lewd sex acts and all the rest of it, but yes. All right, let's carry on. What is Labyrinth all about? Look, I will do a whole stream on Labyrinth one day. In fact, during the Bowie Deepest Law, I have earmarked the 80s stream to be a solo stream because I don't want one, none of the other guests are into Bowie enough to be able to do the 80s stream. And two, that will give me license to freewheel on Labyrinth and why it's such a brilliant film in the middle of that. Okay. Top Gun. Yeah, I know people who went to see Top Gun 2 like 7 or 8 times already. People are really raving about that film. And I've yet to figure out why that is. Actually, Labyrinth is not a coming-of-age story, Cassius F.A. It is what you might call a reverse Buildings Roman. A Buildings Roman is a coming-of-age story in which a young protagonist kind of grows up and learns how to be an adult. Sarah in The Labyrinth is actually a teenager or an adolescent, younger teenager who thinks she's older than she is. And the whole problem of the film really is that Bowie, Jareth, is a manifestation of her adolescent desires, and she's in over her head. She is put in situations that are clearly too old for her, and she's not comfortable. She's not old enough to be dancing with Bowie in that mask. She's not old enough to be in the situation that she finds herself. So in a strange way, the whole film is her coming to terms with the fact that she has to accept, she has to accept basically the reality of who she is as a, you know, she's in a broken home. She's got a, you know, we figure out she's got a, you know, stepmother or a stepfather at the start of the film. And she's got this kind of adolescent fantasy of being able to engage in all of this make-believe stuff. And somehow she's going to be this kind of, I don't know, she wants to transcend her everyday life. And the whole film is about her figuring out, actually, one, you're only 14 or 15, love, so you shouldn't be in these sorts of situations. And two, you know, even be that as it may, there's still some responsibility. You can't just give your brother away to the bloody Goblin King. So be careful what you wish for and be grateful for the things that you've got. So it's not really coming of age in that sense. In fact, there's a whole genre of narratives that are like this. And they tend to have young women at the center of it. The most famous one is Alice in Wonderland. It's a reverse Buildings Roman. Again, Alice kind of overrates herself. She thinks she's wiser than her years, and you know, by the end of Alice in Wonderland, she's taught to come back down to earth a little bit. I'm trying to think of some other examples. There's one called there's like an animated movie called Coraline, I think it was. She had like buttons for eyes or something, like patchwork. That was also a reverse Buildings Roman as well. Yeah, they tend to be young girls in fantasy settings for those sorts of stories, whereas the Buildings Roman tends to be a young male hero for some reason. So Wizard of Oz, I'd have to think more about Wizard of Oz, but there's loads of other ones. Return to Oz, if you've ever seen that, that's more in the mold of a Buildings Roman. You see, the key point is that the young female protagonist, she doesn't have to be a girl, but they're mostly female, they tend to find themselves in these situations where they're clearly in over their years and experience, and they freak out. In Return to Oz, of course, there's all sorts of horrible things that she comes across. Not just the Wheelers, that bloody queen who takes her head off. It's really quite scary. And it's obvious that she... It's this kind of... the realization that these girls come to in each of these narratives is, actually, yes, I'm just a child. And that's all right. But they all imagine in their heads that they're older than they are. And I don't know if that's a good, I mean, I don't know if there's any women watching this, but maybe that's something that young girls do. Maybe, you know, they always say that girls mature faster than boys, but sometimes they may think they're adults before they are. So, yes. How much have you looked into the Earl of Oxford being Shakespeare? Well, I actually interviewed the head of the Oxfordian Society once, and I thought his arguments were absolutely rubbish. The trouble with the Earl of Oxford being Shakespeare is that he died, of course, right in the middle of Shakespeare's career. So you have to post-date all of the plays, and then you have to explain away all of the references that happened after the Earl of Oxford has died. you have to start arguing, while The Tempest wasn't really written in, you know, at the end of Shakespeare's career. It was really written in 1598 or something. So how do you explain these references that clearly show that, you know, James was on the throne? Ah, oh, well, but so that's, you know, that's the hardest and easiest answer as to why it wasn't the Earl of Oxford. But there are loads of other things, too, like Shakespeare didn't come from a rich family, and he left school at the age of 12. His father was a glover. Called John Shakespeare, and he worked in a... So Shakespeare left school at 12, and he went to work in a glove shop, making gloves. Now, given that he grew up basically in a kind of trade household, you know, as a kind of artisan, you'd expect somebody like that to have, like, really good knowledge of making gloves, maybe some herbal remedies, things like that. What else would you expect of them? You'd expect them to have, like, good knowledge of the area of Stratford and around Warwick, right? And you'd expect them, because he left school at the age of 12, you'd expect him to not be that great at Latin. He'd have, like, schoolboy Latin, essentially, and maybe he didn't learn Greek at all. And that is exactly what you find in Shakespeare. He has curiously esoteric knowledge of glove making. He's curiously, like, he knows the localities in and around Warwick. He gives Warwick in the history plays kind of curiously, like he's oddly presents him as a good character for reasons unknown. So all of those things, just in the plays themselves, you think, well, okay, if it's this nobleman, how the hell did he know all these things then? And also, why was his Latin not up to university standard like all of his contemporaries? And how come he didn't speak any Greek? You'd have to explain those things. And then you say, oh, well, yeah, he would have been faking it. Oh, right, okay. And then you have to explain other things, like how did William Shakespeare, the real-life man, buy a house with 10 fireplaces in Stratford called New Place? We know he cheated on his taxes a few times and hid tithes up in his attic. Well, where did William Shakespeare, the glovemaker's son, get that sort of money? We know that he had two daughters, and that one of them married a physician and a doctor who also bought a very big house in Stratford. And the other one, Shakespeare didn't seem to get on with, and he disinherited his son-in-law. And in Shakespeare's will, he specifically cuts out this son-in-law. It's like, well, if it's the Earl of Oxford, what's all this bullshit he's making up then? There's just too many things for it to not be him, essentially. But the most compelling piece of evidence is the fact that Shakespeare, the real life man, was a 10% stakeholder in his company. He was a famous playwright in his own day. other playwrights talked about him. He was well known. He wasn't like some nobody. He was like he was a star playwright. Plays would be put on, and just like, you know, oh, here's the latest Steven Spielberg movie. It would have been like, well, here's the latest Shakespeare Company, you know, starring Richard Burbage, written by the star playwright Shakespeare. The guy who brought you Henry VI is now bringing you Henry V. They're actively sold this way. We have records of who was in the company. There are references to the people who were in that company in the plays. We know the name of the clown who was in the company. It was a guy called... Will Kemp, who played Bottom and various other characters. And we know the moment that he left the company, he was replaced by another clown called Richard Armin. And from that moment on, the style of clown in Shakespeare's plays change. Now you're going to have me believe that this traveling group of players who bought their own theatre, really that whole time, that company, rather than their friend Shakespeare being the guy who wrote the plays, it was actually secretly the Earl of Oxford. For what possible fucking reason? So, yeah, it's just stupid. It really is just stupid. The only reason that this conspiracy exists at all is because it's Shakespeare. That's the only reason. It's because he's so famous that he's the only writer that practically everybody in the entire world has heard of. And so therefore, people launch these stupid ideas. There's also an idea that he's Francis Bacon. And I explained why that isn't the case either. Francis Bacon wrote his own books. He was into science. He was clearly a man who was very urban and very educated. And he had fantastic Latin. That's why he wrote his books in Latin. And you'd have to explain why the poetic genius in Shakespeare is not present in Bacon. And you'd also have to explain why the obsession with science in Bacon is not in Shakespeare. I mean, it's clear that if Shakespeare had sympathies, it was towards the ancients. And it was clear that if Bacon had sympathies, it was towards the moderns. I mean, if you read his New Atlantis, it's basically a kind of utopian fiction where he puts the scientists in charge. Shakespeare would never have put the scientists in charge. So, yeah, I just think that these conspiracies are extremely silly. And fly in the face of just like basic common sense. Okay. Why stop saying Bacon? Why? People say Bacon, people say Earl of Oxford. I mean, the Bacon argument at least has this right going for it. Francis Bacon didn't die in the middle of Shakespeare's career, but the Earl of Oxford did. So, like, it could at least feasibly have been Bacon because he was alive. If it was the Earl of Oxford, you have to backdate all the plays as well, which is just moronic. Okay. Was David Letterman the last entertaining late-night US talk show host? Well, to be honest, Pleasure Pain, I've never really watched those American talk shows. We had Wogan in this country, and later on we had Jonathan Ross. But I've seen a few kind of videos. I like to watch things like Richard Burton interviews, and sometimes I watch, like, I don't know, Marlon Brando, or just famous old people, like famous old stars, their appearances on talk shows. Bowie, for example, I've watched a lot of his appearances on the talk shows. I have to say that the one that seemed like it was most my style and the one that I enjoyed watching most was a chap called Dick Cavett. It seemed to be a bit more off the beaten track, the Dick Cavett show, but that seemed to be those Dick Cavett interviews seem a lot more watchable than the kind of schmaltzy kind of main, like primetime shows to me. So, yes. Yeah, Parkinson as well. But I find Parkinson, ever since I noticed his wormy tactics when he was interviewing Muhammad Ali, I've kind of gone off Parkinson a bit, to be honest. But Dick Cavett is the one that, for some reason, he seems to just let the guests shine more. And he seems to have, like, cooler guests as well. So, what else? Let's have a quick look at the actual super chats, if anybody's sending those as well. I'm sipping my coffee here, folks. Malcolm McKee says, your Twitter thread on Jazz Origins astroturfing is gone. I tried to talk to my dad about it, but he wanted elaboration. Any chance of a deep lore on it? Well, Malcolm, I don't think I can touch that topic here on YouTube. The best source for it is the car manufacturer, who has an essay on Jazz in the selected volume. So you will have to take those few clues and find the source material on the Jazz stuff in there. Spud Rucker says, what about the effects of exposure to porn in adolescence? Yes, I think that's probably rather harmful. I would suggest that it probably has the effect of lessening the amount of sex that teenagers have. The easier porn is to access, the more young men will waste their seed, so to speak, and not chase girls. That's basically the calculus I would make. I don't think it would make any difference to girls whatsoever, of course, because the driver for sex is always from men. Doesn't matter what feminists tell you, doesn't matter what horny girls tell you, the driver for sex always comes from men. So that would be the chief detriment of porn, is lessening the appetite of men to do the Red Hawk thing. What else? Speaking of Red Hawk, by the way, I don't know if he's mentioned this, but he may have a show coming soon, which I'm looking forward to. Spud, Chris Brimer says, Salo was an astonishing film. I didn't know it features Sargon of Akkad and an aspiring libertine. Salo is a film that was so disgusting that I felt tainted by it for weeks and weeks on end. And I remember I was working in Chicago on an event, and we had a few days there, and you know, the team, they were out, they were having like cocktails on the roof and doing all that sort of stuff, and I was so obsessed with what had happened in Salo, I went to Chicago Public Library, I left my colleagues having a party on the roof, and I said, I'm just going to take a wander, and I went to Chicago Public Library, and I checked out all of the books of Chicago on Salo or on Pasolini that they had at the Chicago Public Library, just for my own interest. And I spent a couple of hours reading around Salo while I was in Chicago. And I came to the conclusion that the film is actually not about fascism as people think. It's actually about the bourgeois drive to a quantified taste, to try to categorize taste. And that is why when they have their kind of, there's a number of ways that the bourgeoisization and the commodification of taste and pleasure comes to be a kind of deadening spirit because it's the reign of quantity, right? So they bring out those various platters of shit at one point. Sorry for the spoilers, folks. And if you remember, the libertines, they're like trying to like taste different strains and different flavors, and they're trying to, you know, they're trying to turn it into a kind of delicacy, right? And then same goes later on with their, all their various acts of violence and torture and sex and debauchery and so on. Curiously, they strip the joy out of everything. Everything is kind of deadened under the weight of their kind of attempt to calculate, you know, total hedonistic pleasure or whatever it is that they're trying to get out of it. So I actually thought that it was a critique of bourgeois materialism or bourgeois, this kind of bourgeois spirit that deadens anything that's real or alive. That's what I would say, which obviously would be missing in the original Marquis de Sade text. Obviously, I don't think the Marquis de Sade was making that comment. I think Pasolini, as a filmmaker, was making that sort of comment, and that the libertines in the film are not fascists. They are literally the audience. They are us. They are the middle classes who go and watch films like Salo. That's my reading of the film. Yes. Bolero 393 says, Foundations of English Literature when? Well, I could do that whenever. I could do that whenever. I might do a Shakespeare course if there's enough demand for it. But I don't know. I'm not sure about it. I was thinking of like booking out a small venue and have it saying like, listen, I'm going to do this course once for 10 people and they can pay a grand each. And I'll just come out of retirement once and do this one course, you know, maybe I'll do that rather than, because it's in order to teach English and Shakespeare in particular, I feel like I want seminars and I want to do group work. We'll see when I have to get, I'm going through this certification thing at the moment, and hopefully soon all of the courses will be certified and carry a kind of thing that you can put on your CV with it as well. If that happens, maybe I'll do the Shakespeare stuff. We'll see. Monothalmos says, I just bought Shakespeare's Moral Compass. Better be good. Well, I hope it's. I hope you enjoy it. Monothalmos says, I do know one reviewer read that book and claimed that I was staunchly socially conservative or strong social conservatism or something he said in there. There are some base themes, I suppose, in that book. Monothalmos says, the memoirs of Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone are great. Besides being great actors, the former was a great man of action and the latter was very based. Wasn't Errol Flynn like Christopher Lee, I believe Errol Flynn was actually a very good swordsman in real life. I could be wrong on that, but... Colonel Crayon is not Monothalmos. It was Colonel Crayon who bought the book, not Monothalmos. Sorry, I am corrected. My eyes just flicked up and looked at the wrong name. Years the Eunuch says, what is the most personally impacting truth you have discovered via your work? Please cite at least one thing that changed how you view life or yourself in a major way that came from your research. Do you mean research I did for the channel or research I've done for my books years? You can just say in the chat. Do you mean stuff I've researched for books or stuff I've worked for? I'm just waiting for years to answer. I would say the most, the thing that impacted me most was my realization that culture is always top down. I would say that, and a lot of other conclusions flows from there, right? Because if culture is top down, you cannot be laissez-faire in politics. You cannot, that one fact that culture is top down invalidates libertarianism. So, and my basic realization of this fact, which I had always kind of known, I mean, if you look at these retrospective videos, check the dates at the start and see when I was saying stuff. You'll see I was saying stuff in 2018, even in 2017, that I later fleshed out. And at some level, I had always suspected the culture was top down, you know. But once you accept that, and it can be quite a bitter pill, once you accept that, you then accept actually the left are playing the correct political game, and the libertarians and the right have been playing the wrong political game. The idea that there's going to be a spontaneous order, right? It's just spontaneously there's going to be a cultural order is bollocks. It's never spontaneous, right? It takes action. It takes planning. It takes concerted effort and organization. And the idea of spontaneous emergent order, we're going to be talking about this on Wednesday, completely undersells the extent to which there has to be conscious action. Nothing just happens by itself. And in fact, in fairness to Ludwig von Mises, Mises always said humans must act with a conscious and rational plan. It was Hayek and some of the other free market theorists who were taken by the idea of spontaneous order. Mises did not believe in spontaneous order. He was like, no, you need a plan. People need to do things. Nothing happens by accident. They happen as a result of people planning and doing stuff. So, you know, when I attack libertarians, I'm not attacking Ludwig von Mises, because he at least got that, as did Rothbard, who was a disciple of Mises. But a lot of the other free market theorists were, and classical liberals were, very taken by the idea of spontaneous order. Spontaneous order is absolute bollocks, right? The only reason that Adam Smith and Ferguson and Hume and these other people believed in a spontaneous order is because everybody around them was so Christian that, of course, wherever they stood, they'd make a Christian society around them. But it wasn't spontaneous. There was a church, an organized church that they all belonged to and affirmed every day in prayer that maintained that way of being. You're not going to get it if you don't have those things. So, yeah, so, sorry for the rant, but, you know, I think this is important. AA, is the idea of freedom from coercion invalid? Yes. Because there's no escape from politics, and at some level, politics is about getting people to do what they don't want to do. End of. So you're never going to get total freedom in that sense. It's just a pipe dream. It's one of the four myths of liberalism that I talk about in Populist Delusion. Who is the most damaging thinker after Rousseau? Says Gaius Julius Caesar. I think it's John Stuart Mill, the so-called father of liberalism. John Stuart Mill is the most damaging thinker. His utilitarianism is bollocks. His atheism was destructive. His utilitarianism gives rise to the reign of quantity that Guénon talks about. His maximization of hedons and all this stuff is bad. His idea that things need to be run to the maximization of liberty is not true. Mill, basically. uh Musky Tyrant says, have you seen the film The Mercy featuring Colin Firth? I'd be interested in your opinion. No, I have not seen that. Lady of Shalott says, my cousin watched He-Man endlessly. So did I, Lady of Shalott. You know, if you'd met me as a 5 or 6 year old, I'd probably have pulled out my sword and I'd have said, I am Adam, Prince of Eternia, Master and Commander of the Castle Grayskull, etc. What else? Thank you for all the blessed views. Very nice. Very nice of you all. Yes, Mises and Rothbard both endorsed voluntary exchange. That is correct. But Mises and Rothbard did not believe that society was a spontaneous order. They believed it was the result of conscious planned action. They just thought that you'd get better conscious planned action through the figure of the entrepreneur, you know, making their own businesses rather than through the instrument of government. So that, you know... any thoughts on the nature of law going to try to apply the populist delusion and elite theory to jurisprudence? Well, of course, Carl Schmitt is your man for that. And his basic idea is that there's no such thing as neutral law. No such thing as neutral law. Okay. DC says, is the correct way to read Shakespeare in terms order, preparation, additional material, cliff notes, etc.? Yes, I am an absolute Philistine. DC, I would say that the easiest way to read Shakespeare, get a copy of the play text, right? Make sure it's a correct play text. I recommend people buy the Norton Shakespeare, right? Edited by Stephen Greenblatt and friends. Or you can get a copy of the Oxford edition on which the Norton Shakespeare is based. It's the same basic text. Those are your plays. You only wrote 37. They're all in there. Decide what you want to watch, right? And then get a complete film or TV version of the play and basically have a copy of the text open in front of you and watch it. And kind of, if you can, read along as they're going on the screen. A very good set of productions to do that with are the cycle that the BBC made in the late 70s and the early 80s. There's a BBC collection. You can get them all on DVD, but I'm sure they're available online. And probably watching those with the copy of the text in hand so you don't really miss what they're saying, or you could stick the subtitles on. That would be the best way, I would say, to get into Shakespeare. Doesn't matter which plays you encounter first. There's no correct order. Shakespeare was a genius, so there's literally, even his worst plays have got something in them. You can watch Timon of Athens and still get something from it. So, yeah, that would be my recommendation. And then once you've watched it and you've taken it in and you've kind of figured out, I mean, probably a good test is who is who, right? While you're watching, who are all the different people and what's their relationship to each other? Did you understand that? Did you understand who does what? If you're not understanding those things, you need to improve your kind of comprehension. So maybe after you watch it, you could try to do a map of all the characters and what they do. And, you know, did you understand the plot? Did you understand, well, this guy was the Duke and he was the lead, the highest ranking character on stage. And this guy was just a servant and that was his wife. And, you know, this guy was an earl and he was actually had a secret plot to do this. If you can't do that, you're not actually understanding the plays at a basic level. And then assuming you can do that, I would then read the introductory essays in your edition. If it's the Norton, there's an essay at the front, or if you buy the Cambridge editions, there'll be an essay at the front. And then you can then you can have another route around if you want more. Okay. Vaza says Baudelaire's dream in consideration in the future. Maybe. I mean, I might ask Gio on to do board to do him. He seems to know a lot about that. There's a lot of good Persian restaurants in London. I don't know about good, but they're certainly Persian. Hey, I used to live in London, the centre of Poznan diversity. Well, Cringebot, I don't really live in London. I just live outside of London, and it's not that bad once you're outside. It's like anything else. It's like if you ever go to Illinois, right? There's the middle of Chicago, and then there's the bits outside of Chicago. Who lives in those bits outside of Chicago, and are they nice? London's the same. You know, the Green Belt where I live is pretty nice. Lots of rolling, loads of royal parks and trees, and you know, it's almost like living in the countryside. Only you're next to a big city if you need it. So, Jacob says, does that back certify? Yeah, I asked the guy on the phone that question, and he was like, yeah, basically. He was like, there's nothing, because the courses don't expire, there's nothing stopping you going back in, downloading the certificate now, and just saying, yeah, I did this course, and I've got the certification. So, they should backward certify. And I just thought, I mean, it'll cost me a few grand, but I thought it would be a nice value add for all the people who've done it. And it might, you know, encourage other people who are on the fence about doing a course to do one as well. And I've done it as a professional qualification rather than a higher education one. It's professional development, not higher ed. Because as soon as you involve the higher ed people, then it's like, oh, how many white authors have you got on your course and all that sort of stuff. I don't want any of that sort of oversight. This is more like you're teaching people to do, I don't know, computer programming. Are you teaching those skills and are they up to scratch? Yes. So because a lot of my courses are skills based, I could say, well, look, I'm teaching people how to, I don't know, run a business with Foundations of Economics, say, or I'm teaching people like communication skills on the Trivium, right? Something like this. So you could write it on your CV and there's a tick from the CPT next to it saying, well, yes, you know, we have verified this is a really top-notch course. So, what else? Jacob says, why did you pick an English lit career and degree? I don't know whether I picked it or it chose me, Jacob. That's the question. I'll flip it around. Imagine you were always top of your class in English. And it kind of came to you as a gift. Would you then not do your best subject when you continued on? That's the way round it was for me. And then when I did my degree and I came top of my year group and I had the highest mark in 80 odd years in my college, it was like, well, how can you not? It was like, something was telling me I have to do this, you know? So I don't know how much I followed what I was good at rather than really gave it any real thought. I remember I had periods of my life that I was kind of angry that my school never sat down and said, like, well, listen, 17 and 18 year olds, rather than just pursue academic topics, we're going to sit down and we're going to tell you that if you get into finance, you know, a starter salary for a graduate at an investment bank is 50K. Whereas if you do a humanities degree, your starting salary will be 18K. Nobody ever sat down and told us that. Nobody ever sat down and said, listen, if you get into financial, if you get into financial services and into equities and bonds and things like that, you know, you could be earning six figures by the time you're 28. They never told us that. They were just like, university, university, university. I remember our deputy headmaster standing up at the front of the year group and saying, you know, encouraging us to apply for university when we had to do the UCAS, what was it, UCAS or UCAS forms. And he just stood at the front of the class and he said, you've got the chance now, use it. You know, they were just obsessed with us getting into uni. No thought was given to what we'd actually end up doing. And it was taken as basically automatic, especially somebody like me who was a straight A student. It was just like, there's no question that you're going to go on to university. So I was basically, honestly, honest to God, I was on autopilot until I was about 25 like maybe even older than that. And then I was like, shit, I've been at university for years, got all these qualifications. What the hell am I going to do now? What am I actually going to do? And then I was like, okay, well, I better just, maybe I'll just become an academic then. Seem to be born to do it, you know? So yeah, I would say that I could have given more thought to those things when I was younger. I had a much more romantic dream at one point about being a writer. And I thought, well, I'll support myself by being an academic and I can write books in my spare time. I can write creative fiction and things like that in my spare time. But I then figured that I wasn't really a creative writer either. So that happened too. Have you studied Goethe? Any thoughts? No, I've not studied Goethe. I have read a lot about Goethe through Thomas Carlyle. Thomas Carlyle was the 19th century's major Anglo or the English-speaking world's exponent of German literature. He wrote a book on Richter. He wrote a book on Fichte. He wrote essays on Fichte. And he translated Goethe into English, Carlyle did, when he was young. And he was known primarily in his younger days as the top English exponent of German stuff. And he knew Goethe through, they wrote to each other. I think Goethe died in the 1830s, so Carlyle was still young. But he was profoundly influenced by Goethe as well. So a lot of the stuff I know about German literature of that period is through Carlyle, both Carlyle writing about it himself, but also stuff I've read about Carlyle and the influence of Goethe on him. So, yes. Yeah, I mean, I remember I was working as a conference producer in the 2010. By that point, I had a PhD. I had two books coming. Hello, can you hear me still? Sorry, folks, I pulled my plug out. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Okay. I don't know what I was saying though. All right, you know, I was just saying that back in about 2010, something like that, you know, I already had a PhD by this point. I knew I had two books coming out. And I was working as a conference producer in London. I was in daily touch with all of these kind of financial professionals, you know, traders, market data guys. Like, I knew a lot of people in the financial industry. And I remember, you know, I was a young guy. I was smart. I had a PhD. I knew I had these books coming out. And, you know, I was flying to New York and flying to Chicago. And I was on about 33K, something like that back then. And I got to know some of these, like, finance guys quite well. And I remember, like, them telling me what they, you know, how they started, the sort of hours they worked, and what money they were on. And I almost fainted. Like, I'm being serious. Some of these guys were on 70, 80, 90K by the time they were in their mid-20s. There was one guy who, obviously I'm not going to name him, but he was a Chicago guy. He was a proper Chicago, like, what do they call it? Not white boys London, but he was a proper, like, Chicago trading dude, right? And he was he worked for a super low latency trading firm. And he took a shine to me because he had been an academic before. And he just, like, loved the fact that this kind of Shakespeare scholar was in this financial world. He just thought it was incredible that I was there. And he took a shine to me. So he used to invite me out and he used to show me around and stuff like that. And he was like, one day you're going to write a book about this. I can feel it. I never did write a book about them. But anyway, he told me a lot about how that industry worked. And he kept on saying, like, listen, what are you going back to university for? You won't make any money there. You could just come and, you know, you're a smart guy. You could come and work with us. You know, you'll probably be a millionaire in a few years. And I just remember thinking, like, nobody explains that to you when you're 16. Right? So it's just like, well, oh God, I've done it again, haven't I? God's sake. Oh, how much did I miss? I don't know what I was saying. What I was trying to explain is that if you're from a family who has connections, right? They will be able to know by the time the kid is 8, oh, by the time the kid is 18, they could be working for Goldman Sachs. Or, they could, we have an idea of if you go to this school and this school and this school, by this point, you could be in this industry. But that requires insider knowledge, okay? And I think it works in that way in the law as well. So for example, if you want, like, there will be families who know they've had barristers in their families, and they know their kid is going to go into the law, okay? They will know by the time the kid is 8 which law firms they're going to be targeting, which ID in an ideal world, which law firm that kid is going to work for, okay? Whereas somebody like me, if I was going to go into the law, I wouldn't have even known those firms even existed by the time I was 18 or 19. Whereas that kid has known since he was 7 years old. And this I genuinely believe is the real difference maker in life. As much as ability can get you so far, but when push comes to shove, you need somebody who's connected to those circles to just know. When I was in Oxford, I met a guy who was a lawyer who was training to be a lawyer, right? And he was he had his entire life mapped to the age of 52. He even knew what his career earnings would be by the time he was 51. And he said, if I am not earning this, and if I am not in this place in my career, I'm ready to retire in 5 years, I'm doing something wrong. Okay. I thought he was a psycho, obviously. But the fact of the matter is that he knew all of that because he came from the sort of family that knew that sort of stuff. Whereas most of us don't come from those sorts of families. And I think the true nature of what is called, the left would call it privilege, right? But that stuff doesn't come from money. It comes from being connected to a network that has knowledge of how these things work and of where to target and where to go, which schools to go to, which firms to apply to, what they're looking for. There's a fantastic series that looks at this called the 7-Up series. It's a documentary series where they track the same group of kids at the age of 7, and then they will go back to those same kids when they're 14, and they go back when they're 21, and then every 7 years they go back to the same group of kids. One of the things that's always stayed with me is that the kid at the age of 7 who said he was going to be a lawyer and work for that law firm did exactly that, whereas the working class kid who said he wanted to be a jockey did not become a jockey. He ended up as a taxi driver living in Essex. That's a fantastic series, and it's kind of heartbreaking in many ways, but there was a tremendous predictive power to whether the parents were connected to those things or not. And it's not money, and it's not ability, it's connections. Okay. Let me carry on. It wasn't made in the 90s, 7-Up. It was made in the 60s, I want to say. It started, I think, the first episode's like the early 70s, maybe. It's a great series. But it will make you cry as well. It's not even necessarily who you know as well. I mean, it will help. It'll help if you know people. But it's just knowing that these things exist at all. I think people forget what it's like to be 16 or 17. You don't know what PwC and KPMG are when you're 17, but you might do if your dad works for them. You understand what I'm saying? Matthew Ivy says, what the hell is Keith and his Wiggersburg's issues with Auron? I don't know about that. I do know Auron very well. I'm in touch with him every day. If I know one thing about Auron McIntyre, it is that more than anyone else in any of our spheres, Auron McIntyre is a no drama guy. So there's no point even trying to start drama with him. And don't get me wrong, I'm not going on some kind of working class tirade here or some like class resentment thing. I'm just, as I always do, explaining how the world actually works, how it really is versus how it ought to be. But that may, something like that may explain why I ended up as an academic rather than as an investment banker, for example, or as a lawyer, or as anything else. because that stuff was never explained to me, whereas that stuff would have been explained to one of those kids by the time they were 8 years old. I don't blame my parents for that, because they wouldn't have known either, to be fair. You know, if I wanted to be an engineer, which my dad was, you know, that would have been great. But obviously, anybody who's ever met me would know I would never become an engineer, because I can't even change a plug. All right. Yeah, even less drama than Lambda. Auron is the least drama-y guy. Period. Brad Jepson says there's no stress in academia. I don't know about that. I mean, it's kind of cool, you know, you've got the kind of left your own devices and you've got an office with your name on the door and stuff. But, you know, academia has a lot of very set cycles, right? And it tends to be that everything comes at once. So there are down periods, and then there are periods where you're like, fuck, I have to be up till 4 every night marking these essays, otherwise they're not going to be done. So there are periods of kind of heavy convergence in that field of work. Probably not as stressful as being a trader, though. The flip side is that if you're a trader, you retire by the age of like 35 and, you know, go and invest in an ice cream company and live happily ever after or whatever. So Artemisia Absinthium says, have you come across the theories and books of Elliot Jake's business psychologist? Any thoughts? I have not heard of him. Yeah, you're quite right, Blackwater. Academia is funded by student debt everywhere, not just in America, and it's not sustainable. I worked out before that my old wages were basically inflation. You're paid in inflation. I mean, that's the basic point. Carl Burton says, how do you invest, AA? Badly is the answer. Badly. I've got a few ICEs and things for AAA. They seem to do all right, but whenever I make speculative investments, they always do badly. Like, you know, buying oil the day the fucking market crashes and shit like that. So I don't do it very often, but every time I have done it, it's always gone tits up immediately. I bought Ripple, and then I bought Ripple, you know, the cryptocurrency, and I literally, Ripple had its worst ever day ever and never recovered again. If you pull up Ripple, have a look over a 5-year span and look for the dip that goes down and never recovers. And that was the moment I fucking bought the damn thing. Always the way. So I've learned my lesson that I just don't bother anymore. I just don't bother. The only good investment I ever made was a piece of gold I bought, which long-time viewers will know about. That piece of gold is still sitting in a safe and is probably, like, you know, quintupled its value since I bought it. I can't believe I bought crypto either, Carl. I can't believe it either. But I'm trying to remember. I think somebody sent me specifically some money to put into crypto or something at one point. This was like some big libertarian back in, and I stuck it in Ripple. You know, I looked up some sites. What should I buy? Oh, Ripple. Oh yeah, brilliant. Fucking crash straight away. Brilliant. My other awful investment was Deliveroo. I thought, well, I had a little look around. Yeah, Deliveroo, okay. They've just become an IPO. You know, they seem to be doing well. I've had a little look around newspapers. Yeah, okay. Deliveroo, decent bet, etc. Deliveroo with the worst ever IPO to be floated on the London Stock Exchange. Ever of all time. And still, it's like the value of those shares is a third of the price I paid or something like that. It's just fucking comical. It really is. I've learned my lesson. I'll just, if ever I need to make any investments, I will hire some asset manager who will just do it for me, essentially. That's probably why they get paid money, right? Very unfortunate. I've had three really unfortunate. Ripple, oil, I bought fucking $1,000 of barrels of oil, and the market crashed that night. And I had the, what do they call it, the emergency position on it, where they basically like cashed me out and said, yeah, here's like $600 back, fuck off type thing. Just a disaster. Ripple. All right, sorry. I muted myself again. Why is this my... Hello? Hello? Yes, my fussy mic is driving me nuts. I might have to buy a new one. Yeah, but Ripple, Oil, Deliveroo, my three investments all gone tits up. And for that reason, Mrs. AA said, I'm not allowed to invest anymore, ever again. You know, might as well stick it on the casino or stick it on the derby or, you know, bet it at poker or whatever, but... Yeah, you know, probably would have made a better return on my investment. Okay. What else? Glow in the Dark says, what was the hardest thing you needed to do when you started your journey away from acceptable academia? Nothing. Nothing whatever, glow in the dark. It wasn't hard. I did a few techniques to kind of master my emotions and my mind over matter type stuff. That was the most helpful stuff I did during that period. I did some affirmations, what they're called. It was very liberating. And as soon as I did that, I basically made more money than I had ever dreamed of making before in my life, in a very short period of time, which kind of made it a lot easier to, do more of that basically without having to worry too much. So I am very grateful to the, soft landing I had. And it was because I have such a great audience that I was able to do that. So I am forever grateful to everybody for it. And hopefully I'll never have to go back. I mean, maybe one day if all this, if I stop making money on this, I'll have to look for a job again, right? But at the moment, this has been a lot more interesting than what I was doing. I was getting bored of doing what I was doing before anyway. So it was actually, you know, every cloud, eh? Glow in the Dark also says, what would be your professional wrestler name and gimmick? What would your signature move be? Well, that's a very easy question, Glow in the Dark. My name would be the Velvet Glove, obviously. And I think I would do a move that Ted DiBiase did. If you ever watched The Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, he did something called the Million Dollar Fist Drop. Now, obviously, the Velvet Glove would have a glove gimmick, right? A velvet glove, which secretly would have like a horseshoe in it or something like that. And I think the Velvet Glove's finishing move would be a dirty Million Dollar Fist Drop with a horseshoe in the Velvet Glove. So there we go. Yeah, and obviously it would be a heel. It would be a heel gimmick, obviously. And I think he'd largely be a manager, the Velvet Glove, who would prefer others to do his fighting for him. But if he needed to step in the ring, he could, I suppose. When are we going to do a deepest lore on Prisoner Cell Block H? Sometime in July is good, says Lady of Shalott. Yes, I mean, I have to think about Bowie and Kubrick, but the main hurdle with Prisoner is that I need to watch it. Otherwise, I'm relying on 20-year-old memories. Although, you were impressed how I just plucked Craven out of midair the other day, weren't you, Shalott? I hope you appreciated that. That one was just for you. Craven. Now, apparently Craven was in another Australian sitcom. He was like in Home and Away or Neighbours or something. And I remember I had a friend and they were watching, you know, Neighbours or whatever it was, Home and Away. And I pointed at the screen and I said, "That's Craven." And they were immensely tickled that I know all of these stars from their time in Prisoner Cell Block H, not in Neighbours or Home and Away. So there we go. Yeah, he was Alf in Home and Away. That's right. Yeah, Craven. The thing is that I, because of the age I was and because of the era that I watched it in, I feel like I didn't see early Prisoner. The original Top Dog was only ever talked about and not actually in it when I watched it. And do you remember there was Lurch and Lou Kelly? Like when I started watching it, Lou Kelly was one of the main baddies and Reb Keen was in it. You know, remember she had the teddy boy look, Reb Keen. Lurch was like kind of Lou Kelly's sidekick. That was the era that I came into it. Obviously, the freak was terrorizing people, and there was a pedo woman there, Catherine Connors. What was her name? Like she had like a plait. Was her name Maxine? I can't remember. But she'd like either like killed a kid or she was pedo or something, and she got like really terribly bullied and beaten up and stuff. But she was like a fucking piece of work as well. She was in it when I started watching it. And then towards the end, there was a woman called Rita Connors, was it? She had like a big like mop top and looked a bit like Big Bird from Sesame Street. And she was like a biker girl. Towards the end, she became the top dog. And then, like, I seem to remember they escape, and that was it. So I watched it from the time of Reb Keen and Lou Kelly to the time where Rita Connors escaped. And there was a storyline where the freak, Joan Ferguson, like, it turns out she was a lesbian, and, like, she has a girlfriend who's inside, and then the freak goes inside for a while. That seemed to happen as well, I remember. So... But I don't remember the early series when the older top dog who had gone, I forget her name now, but who was the older top dog? There's an older top dog who was like such a big deal that she'd still be brought up time and again. So I actually knew of this character, but she was actually out of it by the time I'd watched it. Yes. B. Smith, that was it. Tragic Vision. Lovely to see some of the old names back. B. Smith. Yeah, so B had gone. But because she was so frequently referenced, I get the impression that she hadn't long gone. But it was like there was a kind of power vacuum in the prison because there wasn't a proper top dog who'd taken over yet. And there was all sorts of weird things. I remember there was a period where Lurch became the top dog. That was weird. I mean, there was tons of lesbian fights, tons and tons of lesbian fights. And then every once in a while, a man would come and the girls would go wild and it would be like some cheesy kind of dude with a kind of 70s moustache who'd turn up. Oh, look, it's Mike. He's a plumber or... You know, oh, Jim the mechanic's here. Come on, girls. Come on, Sheilas. I loved it. Absolutely fucking loved it. All right. Yeah, and they would literally, they'd be like clawing at the bars, trying to like shag the Do you remember there was the Ponzi what did they call them? The guys, the prison guards. There was the one who was like a real wet lettuce. His name was Martin or something. He looked like Neil Morrissey, but he wasn't Neil Morrissey. And he was just like such a pussy, basically. And they beat him up and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, the Screws. Who was the really wet male Screw? What was his name? Jog my memory. I don't know. He reminded me of do you remember that Robin Maid Marian and her Merry Men, in which Robin Hood was like a really ponce? Like, I mean, he was gay. Like, he was a very gay Robin Hood, and she was a very butch Maid Marian. It was probably an early bit of Pause, actually, Maid Marian and Merry Men, because, you know, clearly Maid Marian was the bloke and Robin Hood was a girl, but they weren't. They, you know, and Tony Robinson was in it. But in that, the Robin Hood, this Screw that I'm thinking of in Prisoner, looked like Robin Hood from that. And he had the same kind of effeminacy about him. Yes. Let me have a look. Male Screw in Prisoner, Cell Block H. Here we go. Screws in Prisoner. I'll find him. Oh, brilliant. Look, there's a list of Screws. The worst Screws. Vera Bennett, Joan Ferguson, that was the freak. Cynthia Leach. She bullied Reb Keane, of course. Sean Brody. Is that him? No, that wasn't him. Oh, no, hold on. This is a fake prisoner. That's not the real ones. Bent Screws. I can't find them now. Oh, I can't find them. It's being messed up with Modern Prisoner. I can't stand that. Okay, what else? If anybody finds the name of that male Ponzi Screw, tell me. Orange Team says, what's your thoughts on Carl Jung? It's funny enough, I mentioned Carl Jung the other day on Twitter. Do you want to see what I read? I said about him. I said, they said this about Carl Jung. Somebody asked me, what do you think of Freud? I said, I believe the entire field of psychoanalysis to be a major node of subversion that Jung partly tried to self-correct with his pure Teutonic spirit. So that's what I think of Carl Jung. Thoughts on the band Gorillaz, says Rogue Crusader. They were all right, I suppose. I like Del the Funky Homo Sapien as an MC. So the tracks where he crops up are quite good. I was a fan of Blur, of course. And, you know, Damon wrote some decent tunes. I like Dan the Automator as a producer. Yeah, they're all right. There's one song that they had that always reminds me of the music from Mario Underwater. Do you remember when Mario has to go, you know, in the original Super Mario Brothers, when they go underwater, the music sounds like under Mario when he's swimming. And it was on one of their later albums. What was that? Gorillaz albums. Listen to it and see if you know what I'm talking about. So was this on Plastic Beach, I think, was the album I'm thinking of. And the track is called White Flag with Bashy and Kano. I always thought the song White Flag sounded like Super Mario Underwater. So that's my main thought on that. Glow in the Dark says, new investments have the highest failure rate. What is advertised as a great investment? Don't believe it. The worst ones are advertised. The good investors hide good deals for richer customers. Yes, probably good advice there. JD says, Monothama says, do you like the Ian McKellen Richard III movie adaptation? Yes, I think it's very good. Yeah, I don't mind it at all. Decent one to watch. JD says, when you see a huge prestigious corporation and wonder how do people actually find a way in, yeah, that's deliberate. It's why I want to go freelance. Colonel Crayon says, money for this nice stream, do Darkness by Byron. And then we had the thoughts on Gorillaz, which I've just done. All right. I think that'll do. Tomorrow I'll be back with the retrospective. It's going to be a 4-hour one tomorrow at 2 p.m. And then after that, of course, we'll be back live with Unpopular Opinions. We'll be doing more Q&A on Unpopular Opinions. It will be a more political theme, although you can basically ask anything you want. I thought it'd be a nice chill way to spend the afternoon. All right. No, what do you mean, super chats? What are you talking about, super chats? I did the super chats. Unless I've missed any. Adam E. says, seems the solution to woke academia and student debt is for people to stop going to uni. When will this happen and what comes next? Dutton did a stream about this in a historical context. Quite good. Well, Adam E., the universities, if you really want to know some inside baseball, the inside baseball is that the population, the student population, that is the total number of people in the age bracket, is low in the next few years. So you are going to have universities in the UK either defaulting or going out of business or having to greatly downsize, because even if they were recruiting at maximum capacity, there is simply not the pool of potential students there. There just isn't enough people to support the growth they need. So yeah, there's going to be trouble in the university sector. That was even before COVID happened. Now COVID has happened and the university experience has been diminished with online learning and so on. They're probably, a lot of them are up Shit Creek without a paddle, to be honest. They can bring in more internationals. They can import, I suppose. But remember that every student who they recruit from abroad is probably battled over by a couple of different universities. So those universities that cannot attract those ones either are going to be in a lot of trouble, because just think, for every student you're missing out on at home because they just don't exist, you need to bring in an international one. You know, and I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying that they've got a struggle. There's a struggle up ahead for most universities. And it won't be a bad thing either, because clearly the sector is full of artificial incentives set up by the Dark Lord, of course. Yes. Now, why was everybody going on about super chats? That was the only one, wasn't it? That was the only one. Calm down, chat. All right. It's important now for you all to get out. I'll just mention again my little tie-in with the retrospective. £100 off all the bundles and academic agency with the code word RETRO. Foundations of Entrepreneurship as well, of course. I'll see you tomorrow. Big Nig 420 says, AA, listen to the album Met My Eyes, See Your Future by Denzel Curry. Okay. What do you mean I missed a lot? What are you on about, the lot of you? I did not miss any. I'm clearly missing something. Oh, right. There was a whole batch I missed. JD says, everybody forget Mises' point on the four freedoms. Yes, JD. I mean, to be fair, Mises doesn't really make the point himself, but he kind of does in his discussion of Ricardo. And one day I'll make a video on that when I get a bit of time. Fishy Frenzy says, do you think video games are a positive influence? Would the millennials and Zoomers be better off without them? To be honest, I think the negative, I think video games are actually do promote some interesting problem-solving skills. They give autists a place to devote certain energies. You know, I was listening to a, if you know Imperium Press, Mike has a podcast on there. I think you have to pay for it, but they did a podcast on the RPG. He has a guy called Dave Martell on with him. And they were basically saying on there that if it wasn't for playing like computer RPGs, probably neither of them would have got into dissident politics. Like they got into a kind of appreciation for myth and the transcendental, as strange as it sounds, through the kind of fantasy gods, things like that. So I don't think video games are inherently bad as a form or anything like that. Now, that's not to say that video game addiction is a good thing, of course. And I think the problem I see with a lot of millennials and Zoomers is that they're just too on their computers all the time and they don't go out enough. But to be honest, I think a lot of them are probably just on the internet rather than playing video games. So I don't know if it's a problem inherent to video games or just as a culture that doesn't promote people going out enough. You know, there's too many shut-in jobs is what I'm saying. So there we go. Judge Caligula Bushman says, so can I still change my name on the certificates from this to my real name? Yeah, I'm sure you can. Yes, of course you can. Merlin says, which Carlyle book should I start with? I've already read Evola and Spengler, if that makes any difference. Start with Latter-day Pamphlets, Merlin. Latter-day Pamphlets, and read the occasional discourse on the Negro question first. Matthew Ivey says, AA, what the hell? So we did that one. That was the batch of super chats that I missed. Well, I hope you're all satisfied now. My coffee has gone stone cold. I'm going to have to make a new one. L. Sid Leon says, National Institute for Gamer Review is a good one. Excellent. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Now get out. What do you mean I missed yours, JD? Stop lying. I did yours about the huge and prestigious corporation. I did that one. And the one about Mises, JD. You clean out your ears. All right. I've had enough. Where is it? Where is he?
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily...